Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, this is Rachel Stewart. I'm a PhD researcher at the University of Kent, and this is the latest in our special series of sex, sexualities, and sex work. And with me today, I have Katie Cruz, who is now going to identify herself to me. Can you tell us who you are, Katie, and your area of expertise?
Yeah, I can. So it's Katie Cruz. I'm a senior lecturer in law at the University of Bristol. And my research is on the relationship between the sex worker rights movement and their demand for rights and the kind of possibilities and limits of law for achieving the aims of the movement. And I teach in the area of labour law and law, gender and sexuality.
So can you tell me how you got into this particular area?
Yeah, so in my 20s, a couple of things really. At university, I did a law degree and I found a lot of it very boring until I got to the third year and we did a module on feminist legal theory. And in that, we read a lot of different feminist theories of sex and sexuality. And that was the first time during my degree that I was really interested in kind of a legal area. And at the time, I read a lot of Catherine MacKinnon and the kind of radical feminist perspectives on sex work. And I disagreed with them, but I didn't really know why or like what the alternative was. At the same time, then just after university, I joined a feminist group called Feminist Fight Back in London, and they were they are an anti-capitalist feminist group that did a lot of campaigning, but also joined up with the sex worker rights movement in London. And it was one of the only feminist groups at that time, I guess that would have been the mid-2000s, that was prepared to organise with the sex worker rights movement. And so it was kind of through my activism that I got more of an understanding of like what sex work was and what it's about and why I disagreed with radical feminism. So I started to put together all of those pieces. And it just seemed that nobody was really writing at that time about the kinds of rights claims that sex workers were making and how they might or might not be achieved legally. So I thought I carried on doing activism with Feminist Fight Back, but also with an organization called Crosstalk, which is a group that was established in London in 2006. The main thing that we did was deliver English classes for migrant sex workers in different locations in London, like brothels and NHS clinics. So I continued to do that work and I was getting more and more of an insight into like what the industry was like and the kind of legal vacuum really in which it exists. At the same time, I felt like there's this kind of emerging sex worker rights movement that wasn't getting the same attention that the kind of criminalization and the radical feminist perspective on sex work was. So I thought at that time, well, maybe that's something that I can write about. Maybe I can do interviews with sex worker rights activists and try and scratch below the surface, you know, what's beyond the kind of rhetorics of rights. Like, it's important, isn't it, to use that language of sex workers' rights or human rights, but what does that actually mean? For translating what does it mean strategically? Some of it is about race and consciousness and humanizing sex workers as workers. But then I was also interested in that next part about what can the law do, and thinking quite creatively with the law, like in England and Wales, prostitution is criminalized. So for me, you know, you can say, well, it should be decriminalized. And then the question becomes, well, what can law do to give rights to sex workers beyond decriminalization? So that goes a bit further on in my thinking. But yeah, what got me started was a combination of like learning about feminism at university, doing feminist activism, and trying to then bring that, you know, into relationship with my interest in law, really.
Yeah, and it's a really good opportunity as well to bring the conversation around sex work back to a conversation about workers' rights.
Yeah.
And to kind of recenter that conversation, because I've recently been reading, is it Brooke Beloso, who talks about how dangerous it is when we consider sex work, but only through a kind of gender gaze or a sexualities gaze, that we lose context of this as actually a site of work.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think that if we lose sight of it as a site of work, then we're only thinking about it in the context of kind of gender oppression, or like about like a kind of expression of sexuality on the part of like the client or the sex worker. Like what we're missing is a kind of class-based dimensions of sex work. So there's, you know, it's often a transaction, like a, you know, tripartite transaction, but there is often a boss or somebody who's managing the work of the sex worker.
Yeah.
So it's not just a service that's being provided, it's also a working relationship.
Yeah.
And I think that we lose sight of the, so that's what I've been trying to think about, is like, well, what is it as work? But I know like that sociologically a lot of work has been done on that, thinking about it as kind of embodied and emotional labor. But I guess I'm more interested in the kind of Marxist feminist questions about what it is as work, and then what the law can do to respond to it. In that way,
And that's really interesting from my point of view as well, because my research about webcam performers, I wasn't really interested in the dynamic between the performer and the customer, or how she felt. I was much more interested in the dynamic between herself and the webcam hosting sites that own the stream that she produces. You know, and that tends to be overlooked. And I think it's really interesting because as we're talking a second about stripping, that the less that we talk about the dynamics between the sex worker and the other social actors on the field outside of the customer, what we do is we create a real sort of tunnel vision that doesn't give us a broader picture of where potential exploitation really lies.
Yeah, no, definitely. I think that's a problem, I think, with a lot of studies of sex work, both on the side of, not the problem, I shouldn't say the problem, I guess there is a lot of focus on the client, in the sense of, you know, the radical feminist person, an exploiter or an abuser, or then the other perspective, which is, you know, it's just a service user, would be, and I think that neglects, but there are interesting legal questions there too. If it is just a service, then how do you enforce kind of like, the kind of service contract between the parties? You know, can sex workers discriminate against who they sell their services to if it's like a provision of a service, you know?
Yeah.
And they discriminate on the basis of like race or age, these sorts of questions. Like, I don't really feel like those have been, you know, tackled in as much depth as we could. But then I think also, what gets neglected then is that third party, and which is the often the person who manages the site or manages the brothel or manages the exchange in some way. And I think from my perspective, I would always see the intentions of that actor being to exploit the worker, like structurally, like there is an imperative that they have to exploit the worker in order for them to even want to do it. That's the intention behind it.
But it's quite funny you should say that, because that exploitation of the worker, is that an exploitation of a worker, not an exploitation necessarily of a sex worker? They would exploit you any way that they could, you know. And also as well, I find really interesting, we don't really talk about it, this kind of elitist exploitation of sex working women is far older than we actually give it credit for. I mean, you know, the whole of the Roman Empire seems to have been run on the slave prostitution of people in slavery, and the benefits to the elite slave owners. I mean, it goes back, millennia,
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I think that's what I've been interested to try and do, is to think about sex work in the context of like different modes of production. So like, you know, you had this different modes of production historically, and we're in a capitalist mode of production now. And like, so how does that work? And to like not think about sex work, to start off from the basis that it's work, like we all have to sell our labor in exchange for a wage under capitalism. So that's a kind of like common denominator. And yeah, whenever we do that, we're exploited and alienated from our labor to varying degrees. Like that's a kind of common starting point. And to think of sex work in that context, and to think about how that exploitation and alienation is gendered, like, and how it's racialized and all of these things. So not to see sex work as starting from the perspective of it being different, but starting from the perspective that it's exploitative and alienating work. But that doesn't mean that it should be criminalized, because all work is that.
Yeah. And do you think like, so like this kind of expanded view that you've got came about as a consequence of your engagement with sex workers? Because what I've noticed of research that either doesn't engage sex work or only engages sex workers on a like a really kind of superficial level tends to fetishize the sex workers, the sex working aspect of the sex workers' lives. Yeah. So then we sort of limit their lives, their interaction with the customers. We don't look at the bigger picture. I mean, it's basically a call for participatory activist research, which basically what you've done.
Yeah, no, definitely. I think that like participation, like within the sex worker rights movement, and seeing how it actually functions and how it is just like a mundane job was really helpful for me. And also doing that kind of activism and like kind of the kind of Marxist feminist activism I did. And I probably learned more like intellectually doing that than I did at university. And like, that really helped me to see that, you know, a real fundamental thing that we need to think about in society is how capitalism structures our lives.
Yeah.
And that's the kind of place that I think it's best to start from, without being reductive about what class is. But we, you know, that's the kind of antagonism around the exploitation of our labor, that's what we all face. And like, it seems like a kind of common experience for all of us to kind of organize around. So yeah, it was definitely the activism and you know, participation in efforts, you know, with sex workers that helped me see.
Yeah. So the reason why I invited you today is because you've written a chapter in a book that's forthcoming. Can you tell us what the name of the chapter is?
Yeah, so is this the Chandler one?
Yeah.
Yeah, I can. It's I should have said it's forthcoming in Studies in Political Economy, which is a journal in Canada. It's Dancers, Win at Work, Unionisation, and the Nowick and Chandler Bars Group Limited.
Okay.
And it's an article that I've written with Camille Barbagello, who's a research fellow at Leeds University.
So do you want to tell us about Novak versus Chandler?
Yeah, no, it's an interesting case, because we can kind of understand it, I think, in the context of a lot of the kind of other gig economy cases at the moment, like the Uber case that went all the way to the Supreme Court recently. But there's this category in UK labour law that kind of sits between employment and self-employment. It's called worker status.
Okay.
And if you can show that you're a worker, then you're entitled to minimum protections at work, including things like holiday pay and minimum wages. The article is based on an employment tribunal claim by Sonia that was made, that was heard actually early last year. And in that, she successfully argued...
You've just gone quiet.
Oh, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't know where I got to, but Sonia she made a claim that she wasn't actually just self-employed by the club. So I think it's Browns in London in Shoreditch. She said, you know, I'm not just merely self-employed. I can't come and go as I want. You're not just providing me with a space to dance. Actually, you're controlling my labour. I can't substitute my labour. There's a rota. All of these things, which allowed her to, you know, successfully claim worker status, which means that they have to pay dancers in that club holiday pay. They have to pay minimum wages. They can't dismiss workers on discriminatory grounds. The dancers have protections against whistleblowing. So there's a bunch of things that worker status allow you to have. It's not quite the same as employee status. Like, so you don't have protection against unfair dismissal. but it's basically this category. I think one way it's useful of thinking about it is being a dependent entrepreneur. So you're self-employed, but you're dependent on a particular company for your work.
Okay.
So that's what she was able to argue, that she was in some ways self-employed, but she was dependent on Browns for her income, which now means that those obligations. So her work doesn't change. It's the club that has to abide by its statutory obligations now to pay her things like minimum wages.
So what prompted the case? I mean, why did you do the case?
Yeah, it's interesting because I think part of the reason is that the union, the United Voices of the World Union, have been organising strippers. So there's been like a kind of two things. I think it's organisers around the women's strike and Decrim Now have been thinking, and that's why Camille was involved in the article, because she's been doing a lot of this organising. So Decrim Now, the campaign, talks about decriminalisation of sex work, but they're attaching that to claims around labour rights. And they decided to start trying to organise strippers because they're already a decriminalised group of workers, therefore they can start making kind of labour rights claims. So it's a combination of Decrim Now and United Voices of the World Union coming together and kind of, you know, raising consciousness in the clubs in London, saying like, you know, you are entitled to these protections, and trying to get people to join and take, you know, and take those claims. But I don't think it's been uncontroversial within the clubs, obviously. Like, I think the clubs themselves and a lot of dancers are, obviously the clubs are anxious about this because they like the way things are run now, because they have there's no economic risk that falls at their door. Like, you know, if the dancers don't earn anything that night, they don't have to pay them anything. Whereas if they have to comply with the statutory obligations, then they have to pay them at least the minimum wage when they go home.
Mm.
So obviously the clubs don't want any of these obligations to fall on them. And then a lot of dancers think that their work is going to get worse if they're not self-employed. So there's this kind of false idea about, and I mean, this is a classic kind of tactic that companies use, like Deliveroo and Uber. They've all been guilty of kind of putting out this idea that if you go to an employment tribunal and get your rights, your work is going to get worse, in that we're going to be able to control you more and tell you what to do, and they've told dancers that you'll only earn a minimum wage, which isn't true. That's just like the floor that they can't go below.
Yeah,
on top of that, it's been quite controversial, but I think that's what started it really, was the Decrim Now campaign in combination with these interesting kind of grassroots unions that are emerging, like the United Voices of the World Union. What's the other one? The IWGB, International Workers of Great Britain, I think.
Okay.
And they're quite interesting in that they're organising a lot of migrant workers and, you know, service workers. So they've taken a kind of an interest in organising strippers too.
Yeah, I mean, I was quite interested in just like how aggressively anti-union people like Deliveroo are, and I think Amazon as well.
Oh yeah, no, they're guilty of like even giving incentives to workers to work outside of the area where meetings are being held, in order to not participate in meetings. I mean, they're doing a number of things, because obviously if they have to comply with their statutory obligation, if they're found to be workers or employees, then that means that there's a cost now to the company that they don't want to, like, so it to me, it shows really the profit motives that companies have, like that's where their interest lies, to make as much money as possible from you as a worker, to see you as kind of a cost to them rather than a human that you need to provide for.
Yeah, I was wondering as well, because obviously I'm very familiar with Browns, like very familiar with Browns, just going to put it out there. Yeah, it's been there for a very long time.
Yeah,
and I'm also very aware that actually a lot of income is generated by strip clubs, not only Browns, yeah, but strip clubs around the fining and the punitive actions mm-hmm. towards workers. So, for example, if you're late or you're talking on your mobile phone or whatever,
yeah.
you can be fined. Does that recognition of the change of status affect the ability for, say, a club to make money out of, you know, indirect money out of the workers? Are they still able to impose fines?
But whether or not they're employees, workers or self-employed, all of those fines should be clearly outlined in the contract. And if they're not outlined in the contract, they shouldn't be. Like, so it doesn't, like, whether or not like, this case has no bearing on the fines, those fines should be clearly outlined. If they're not, then there's a breach of contract that's happened, whether it's a self-employment contract or a worker contract. Hmm. But I think what worker status does do, so say those fines are outlined clearly in the contract, then the worker has to, and they've signed the contract, then they have to comply with those. And you can fine employees, that's all fine. But what it does do is mean that the amount that the dancers are paid can't fall below the minimum wage.
Okay.
So, yeah. So I think, do I cover the fines question in? Yeah, so there is, you're right, there's a kind of combination of things that the clubs do. They there's often a system of fines for disobedience and the house fees that we all know about. The fact that there are fines and high levels of control in place points to them being something other than self-employed. Yeah. You don't really tend to fine people who are self-employed for not coming to work on time. No. So like that level of control points to them being something other than. So if you want to fine me, then I'm not self, it's likely that I'm not self-employed. Therefore, you have to give me my worker protections, which include holiday pay, which include minimum wages. You can't sack me for whistleblowing about the industry, these sorts of things.
Yeah, so this is because stripping's like a really interesting case study, isn't it? In this desire to reach like smooth capital. Smooth capital is quite this interesting sort of concept that Deleuze and Guattari come up with. And I think Negri and Hart as well discuss it, and they discuss it. Beyond legislation is where you need to be in order to make smooth capital, i.e. capital with no workers' rights, no wages, you know, just limited overheads. And so, you know, sort of like when the downturn of the economy happened and the strip clubs weren't so popular anymore because people have got so much money to spend. So then the onus, the responsibility of generating income shifts from the club to the customer, from the club to the performer.
Yeah, no, I don't really know about that. Well, I don't know about that concept, but that makes sense to me. And so the trying to exist outside of the kind of legal obligations that you would have as an employer, because that's the best way for you to manage the kind of economic risk that comes with owning a business, especially when times are tough. You know, like you want like what it's called like flexibility, isn't it? Like that the employer wants a very flexible workforce.
Yeah.
To be able to say that we're just providing you with a space to earn money and you just pay us for free. We're not doing anything beyond that. We're not telling you what to do but then when you look closely, actually, you know, the dancers are being told what to do. It's not, and I mean, you know, if you're self-employed, you can send somebody else to work for you. Can you imagine if a stripper sent their brother to work for them? It's just not acceptable, is it?
But it's really interesting as well because it kind of like brings into debate the questions of the limitations of smooth labour, of smooth capital in a physical space. Because the good thing about places like Browns and Spearmint Rhino is they're tethered to a location.
Yeah.
So they can, you know, you can bring criminal actions against them. You can bring legal actions against them. But that's not the case with the online stuff.
Because
there's a real sort of like a parallel here with, well, it's almost like an improvement on the strip clubs by webcam hosting sites, because, you know, they totally abuse any type of workers' rights to the extent that I've interviewed women who have, you know, sort of like transgressed one of the rules of the site. And so their account has been closed down, including all the money that they've earned that week. So they've lost thousands of pounds and there's no recourse. So not only are they no longer got an income, the income that they've generated is lost.
Yeah, it would be interesting to see the kinds of contracts that that are in place. You know, what the performers are signing up to, because I mean, you don't need to have like workers' rights to have like a contract. And if the contract's breached and they're just not paying them, like surely there's an exchange of services for the exchange of their performance. Like, yeah, what's the nature of the exchange between the webcam performer and the hosting site?
It's savage. Basically, the performance earns away all rights, including the copyright of the stream. Yeah, so they can use the stream for anything they want. They can use the stream to broadcast like people's images across the internet. You know, they basically sign away their rights. It's a very one-sided contract. But it's almost like capitalism has learned its lesson from, you know, sort of like forms of like sexual labor, like stripping. And it's perfected it online. You know, it's not the online environment doesn't just benefit the performer or the worker. It benefits the third party hugely, with no real kind of like feminist engagement either.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting, and I wonder what it says in the contract about like the non-paid. So the hosting site, I'm assuming, you know, the money goes through them and then comes. How does the money move?
So basically, this is it. It all goes to the banking system. Yeah. But basically the money goes like from the customer to the hosting site. Then the hosting site then takes generally between 50-65% of the earnings and gives the performer between 35-50%.
So it's quite similar how it's organized to lap dancing clubs in a way. Not all lap dancing clubs, but some of them work like that, don't they? That the customer pays the club then deducts the money and then they give it the money, or it's a voucher system or something like that. But I would be so surprised if in the contract it doesn't say that for each of the transactions that the site has to give the worker at least what, like 30-40%. And if they're just withholding that money and not complying with the contract, like, it's not even like a workers' rights issue. It's just a contractual breach.
But the contract is written in such that if you contravene the conditions of the site, which are huge, are subject to alteration at any point, you've breached your contract, and you've got, you know, and also as well, you know, who do you then take that to? Because these are very ephemeral sort of entities.
Yeah, no, it's really difficult to think about how you would do it. I think it's really important that it happens though. And in terms of, you know, like, they can't just withhold that. It wouldn't be unpaid wages like or something like this, but we'd be able to claim some sort of kind of contractual damages or something, or some sort of restitution or something from the site. And that seems like a really important area that people should be thinking about. Even if they are categorized as self-employed, self-employed workers still have contractual rights.
Yeah.
And it does seem like, it would be really important work, I think, for, you know, it would be great if a union got involved with the webcam.
But where would you direct that action?
Exactly, that's the other thing, isn't it? It's really difficult to think about how that, because it all takes part in the kind of private household. Maybe more like a kind of another comparison would be, you know, sex workers who work on their own from home.
But I think the point is it's not where the sex worker is, it's where the hosting site is based.
Yeah.
So that is the beauty, isn't it? This is the perfection of like webcamming over, say, stripping, is that once you're untethered from a geographical position, which legal area, you know, which legal kind of dominion do you fall under?
Yeah, no, I mean, it would definitely, I think it's really interesting, because I would like to think about this more, because I'm really, you know, my focus is always on the relationship between the worker and the boss. And I guess the boss here is the host inside.
Yeah.
So I think it's really important to try and understand more like what's being signed. And, you know, also you can't vary a contract without the agreement of the other party. So if they're just changing the terms of the contract and the workers aren't agreeing to that, or how are they getting them to agree to that? Like, it would be interesting to know.
But it's quite interesting as well, the lack of sort of like, say, sort of governance, feminism, radical feminism with, say, webcamming? Because I know governance feminists very interested in the world of stripping, very interested in the world of sex work generally, totally not interested in webcamming.
It's interesting that they're not interested in it, and when they are, it's perceived as a problem that you can tackle through demand rather than and not an issue that you, because they don't see it as, that's always a problem for me, because radical feminists and a lot of feminists don't see it as work. You never get to the point of thinking about it as a kind of employment relation.
Yeah.
And until you get to that point and think about it in that way, which is, you know, it's really even when you get there, it's like not traditional kind of labor law questions, because it's not like an easy thing to look at, because a lot of it's online. A lot of it's this kind of tripartite relationship where you've got a customer, a worker, and a boss. So it's really complicated when you situate within work. But yeah, a lot of feminists never even get to that point.
Yeah. So about the Novak versus Chandler Barr case, what happened to Sonia?
What happened to her?
Yeah.
I'm just trying to remember the facts of the case now. I'm not sure how long she had been working there. And I guess I could go over a little bit about the facts of the case. You're going to be editing this, aren't you?
Oh, no, we just play it.
Oh, I love it. I'm trying to find the part. I guess what happened to her is that she joined the union and started to talk to them about what was happening within the club. And she also, I think she's part of the Decrim Now campaign. Just through the conversations with her and other people in the club, people started to think about how, you know, well, we're told we're self-employed, but we have all of these sort of obligations on us about when we have to turn up for work, how we book holiday. That, I think there was a sense in the club, which I'm sure happens across lots of the different strip clubs, that there's high levels of control, which doesn't make sense. If we're supposed to be self-employed, surely we should be more autonomous about how we conduct ourselves at work.
So what was the actual kind of like result of the court case? How did the court case pan out?
So in the court, like, it's just an employment tribunal case, and so that means it could be appealed now by Browns. So they might be unhappy with what the employment tribunal have said, and if they are unhappy, which I'm guessing that they are, and they've got the funds to do it, they will appeal this then to the Employment Appeal Tribunal. The sorts of questions that the court were asking was, Browns say that the dancers are just merely self-employed. Is that the case, or is there something more going on here beneath the surface that's not, you know, that Browns aren't fessing up to? And if there are, like, these sorts of extra requirements, you know, if there's a high level of control, if the workers are being required to personally perform the services. So is there a requirement of personal service between the club and the dancers? Well, yes. So they want the specific dancers to go to work and they have to comply with all of these sorts of fines and levels of control. And is there kind of an exclusive relationship between the club and the dancers? Well, yes, they're told really that they can't dance anywhere. They're not allowed to, or they're encouraged not to. So all of these things then become indicators of there being something else going on that's not self-employment.
Yeah.
The court concluded on the basis of those facts that Browns were wrong. They aren't just self-employed. That in fact, what they are, they fall within this category of worker, which means then that they are entitled to their statutory rights as workers. So what that then means for in practice is that the dancers at Browns should get worker protections now.
Okay.
And Browns, so their working environment doesn't change for them at all, because the court said, well, you're already workers in the eyes of labour law. It's Browns that needs to change now, and Browns need to start complying with their statutory obligations.
Okay. And then COVID happened.
So, and all the pubs closed.
Yeah, I mean, which is really unfortunate, because it would have been really interesting to see what the consequences of this action were in the lived experiences of the dancers.
I know. I mean, really interesting, isn't it? The only thing that we could has really happened, which we wrote about in the paper, is that there's been a movement of dancers online. So a lot of the dancers involved in the United Voices of the World Union have started on this online kind of worker cooperative called Cybertees.
Okay.
And that's kind of run by the workers for the workers, which is interesting. I'm not sure what the connection necessarily is between the court case and what's emerged, but like, you could impose on that a view that, you know, the dancers have had their, you know, they've realized that they're being exploited by the clubs, and now they're starting this new thing online, which is, you know, run collectively.
Okay. So has there been any sort of like movement on the part of, like, say, the local council or the government to make sure that the clubs, like, you know, sort of change their sort of modus operandi?
Well, we were hoping. I think that when the Policing and Crime Act 2009 came into force, that gave greater powers to local authorities to regulate what are now called sexual entertainment venues. And there are provisions within that legislation which would allow the clubs, the local authorities, to improve working conditions in the clubs. But that hasn't really been the way in which the provisions have been used. How they've been used more by local authorities is the new provisions around what's kind of colloquially called the NIL policy, which allows the local authorities to say that we deem that this locality should have so many strip clubs or no strip clubs. And that's really what's been used and campaigned around by, and this is happening in Bristol at the moment, actually. The local authority is put out a consultation as to what people in Bristol think about the existence of the lap dancing clubs here.
Yeah.
And this is really what's been happening, is that it's been a combination really of local authorities, radical feminists, people who are kind of gentrifying in inner city areas, who are arguing for the closure of lap dancing clubs.
Okay.
So yeah, local authorities really, and I mean, one of the things that I guess I was hopeful that the local authorities could act as a kind of, in the absence of employment protections, I was hoping that the local authorities would be receptive to dancers going to them and saying, look, these things are an issue in the club. Can you improve the conditions?
Yeah.
Because what they could do, that the local authorities could say, well, Browns, if you don't start having the heating at a certain level, we're going to revoke your license.
Okay.
But dancers, it seems from Camille's work and what we wrote in the paper, that the view on the ground amongst dancers is that they don't want to go to the local authority because they're worried that any complaints against their bosses will be construed as a reason for the club to close rather than for it to improve.
Okay. And so is this the first case of its kind?
Yeah. Well, no, I shouldn't say it's not the first case. It's the first case on worker status.
Okay.
It's not the first case of a dancer contesting their employment status. That was the dancer at Stringfellows a few years ago, Quashy.
Yeah.
The Quashy case, yeah. So she argued that she was an employee, which is a slightly different claim. So she was arguing that she was unfairly dismissed. And to be unfairly dismissed, you have to show that you're an employee. So she was making that claim. And that was really interesting, because the employment tribunal said that she was an employee. The appeal tribunal, no, the first, it went through three layers. The first court said that she wasn't. The second court said she was. And then the court of appeal said she wasn't.
Mm.
So it's not the first case, but it's the first successful case.
And it's quite interesting, isn't it, the way that we have this really sort of narrow focus on victimisation of sex workers, like really, really narrowly sort of confined to that kind of discussion between customer and sex worker. Yeah, but there's this kind of real silence around sort of like more systemic kind of victimisation in some circumstances.
Yeah. So,
in the case of the strippers, this victimization is like ignored. But your other work, the work that you've done in Jamaica, can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so the work that we did in Jamaica is with two sociologists. We wanted to look at the way were in Jamaica, the way in which the kind of modern day slavery narratives and the child sexual exploitation narratives that have kind of been imposed on Jamaica were kind of playing out on the ground and in the lives of those affected. So one group that we were did research with was sex workers. So we're interested in what sex workers had to say about what trafficking and what slavery is, like how useful they found that framework in their organizing activities, and what they think about this narrative of Jamaica being this kind of hotspot of child sexual exploitation, and what sex workers themselves think needs to be done to improve the lives of sex workers and children, you know, more generally in Jamaica. Yeah, and I mean, in the industry in Jamaica, I think, you know, what we found was, you know, systemic kind of gender-based discrimination against, you know, women and trans workers coming from all sections of society, really. But you know, like it didn't seem to us that there was a huge amount of evidence for the sorts of things going on that are said to happen in Jamaica. It's just more kind of mundane day-to-day discrimination, exploitation that's going on. So the Sex Worker Alliance of Jamaica is the organization that we're working with there, which is a sex worker rights collective. And they're arguing similarly around the kind of issues that we had many conversations, and trafficking just wasn't a framework on modern slavery that meant anything to them. You know, what they were concerned with was rights and decriminalization. So, you know, it's another section of the sex worker rights movement who are making the same sorts of arguments.
Yeah. Because it's really funny, isn't it? It's like, you know, because it's so impossible to have a discussion about any type of sex work nowadays without a discussion about trafficking or exploitation. And it's really interesting how actual exploitation is overlooked. Yeah, if there's not a political sort of like benefit to certain sort of like sort of social actors. Yeah. And I'm thinking in particular of sort of like, you know, sort of carceral feminism and sort of governance feminism, and how that those sort of narratives are hijacked, really.
Yeah, no, definitely. Like, yeah, I mean, it just in Jamaica, like even like the notion, like it was kind of, even the notion of being a feminist wasn't so much present there. And yeah, I mean, it just seems like all of the funding that's coming to Jamaica, or the ways in which it's being categorized through the TIP reports and things, neglect really the kind of everyday issues that people are facing in Jamaica. And it just doesn't seem to me that the kind of modern day slavery, the trafficking framework, really captures any of what's going on there. There's not like, you know, the idea that people are being trafficked into Jamaica or out of Jamaica, I just found no evidence. Yeah. That just doesn't seem to be like what is being spoken about. And the idea that there's like modern day slavery, you know, people just talked about living in Jamaica as like economic slavery, like it's not ended. Like it's just, you know, and what you have to look at when you look at Jamaica is, why is it so dependent on tourism? Mm. Like, you know, how did it end up being in this position, and how do people try and like live, you know, and live in a country that's so dependent on tourism, where there's so little opportunities and employment for people? No wonder people, it's obviously a different context, but it's a similar narrative. Like, why do people do sex work? Because it pays better than the alternatives that are available.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean that feeds into the sort of like the narratives that you get from people like Laura Augustine and stuff like that. You know, that the idea that, you know, that for a lot of people, sex work is the best of a limited amount of options. Might not be your only option, but it's probably your best one. You know, all things considered. You know, which kind of like makes me like sort of brings me to this question that I am struggling with at the moment, which is around the role that feminism plays in debates around sex work.
Yeah.
And whether, you know, sort of like, you know, what do you see the role that feminism plays in debates about around sex work? And how do you see, you know, what needs to change, basically?
Yeah, I think, well, I mean, there's, in my view, like the kind of debates around sex work, how they're playing out in feminism at the moment. I mean, I do think that there is a kind of strong I do think the kind of radical feminist perspective is still quite dominant. You know, so the view that women in the sex industry are victims of sexual exploitation, and so therefore, if you're a victim of sexual exploitation, what you do is you criminalize the actor who exploits.
Yeah.
Like, that seems to be like the most dominant narrative. And I think that's what, you know, and there is a kind of way in which then that feminism works with the state to around things like enhanced criminal, you know, so criminal justice responses. So I think that that's useful thinking about that in terms of carceral feminism, like you were saying, or governance feminism. And then I think that but I've always found the kind of perspective that's juxtaposed to that as the kind of, I don't know, liberal feminist perspective, that it's work and about improving the conditions of people in the sector, and they can be a choice, etc. Kind of quite limited. Like, yeah. I think it's an important perspective, but I don't think it's one that understands a lot of the structural issues involved in sex work. But I think that you can think structurally without being a radical feminist would be my kind of provocation. I think that's what feminists need to start doing more, is to think about like the interests involved of particularly bosses and managers, like why they exploit sex workers, what's to gain there, and for feminists to be engaged in those sorts of questions.
Yeah.
Which are like not seen as the kind of more sexy questions around sexual exploitation versus sexual agency. Like, it's not like, I think that's where a lot of feminism happens.
Yeah. Yeah.
I want to take a more kind of industrial relations approach. I think feminists have an important voice there in thinking about, you know, how work is organized in gendered ways, and you know, why is it that the work that women are supposed to do for free in the home when it's commodified is seen as less valuable than kind of the sorts of work that men do in the workforce, or kind of masculine forms of work? So those are the sorts of questions. And then thinking, well, about the limitations of wage labor as a vision of like what we can do as humans.
Yeah.
You know, those big questions about, you know, why do we work so long for so little?
It's quite interesting because, like, I did a podcast a few days ago with Laura Bracewell, who's just written a book called How We Lost the Sex Wars. And her claim is that actually the sex wars turned into a catfight, a binary catfight between radical feminism and liberal feminism. And what gets left in that catfight is the narrative of Black and Third World feminists.
Yeah.
Who are basically saying, actually, both of these sort of binaries are problematic, and we need to be thinking outside of this kind of binary. And I actually, you know, I'm starting to think, and as someone who identifies as a feminist, do we actually need to step aside as feminists when it comes to looking at sex work? Because the relationship between feminism and sex work is so intertwined that it kind of like almost suffocates. So it's hard to actually look at it as being anything other than you know, a legal battle.
Yeah. You know? No, I think that those feminist perspectives map nicely onto different like legal strategies, whereas I think what I would like to do is to say, like, it's important to be a feminist, but I think that the sort of feminism that I want to think about sex work through the lens of is a kind of Marxist feminism that always thinks about the position of labourers and workers, whether it's formal or informal workers, wherever you're located. And I do think that starting from that perspective is more useful and more inclusive and more intersectional than starting from any of the kind of more polarized positions of liberal and radical feminism. So I think feminism has a lot to offer, but it's harder. And I always notice this with teaching too. Students will really latch on to the liberal versus radical feminist position on sex work, because it's quite, in some ways it's very neat, isn't it? And it's very, you can get your head around it. Whereas I think if you think about it in the sense of the position of workers and labourers and how we reproduce ourselves in society and how we live and how we get the necessities we need to survive and how that's all commodified, all of these sorts of questions, then it's much more tricky. It's a much bigger picture, and it doesn't really centre sex and sex work anymore. It's just about living and survival.
Yeah, but I think as well that with the, I think as feminists, like, you know, I'm very interested in the field of social harms, and I think feminism has done a lot of poor women, you know, sort of like a lot of social harms because of the narratives that produces legislations, you know. But even the narratives that are just that tend to look at sex work through these frames of sort of sexuality or sort of gender studies, they can be as harmful, because actually what they do is they distract their conversation away from sex work as a form of work, and with all the inherent potentials or like positions of exploitation that has. And I think as feminists, I think we need to really look at not just what we're saying, but the possible impacts of what we're saying.
Yeah, no, I think that's true. I think that, you know, that's the thing, isn't it? It's like feminism's a really broad church, and it seems like a lot of the dominant voices are those ones that do harm. And I think it's important, and I'm to look at those harms. But I do think that the kind of other worry I have is the kind of narrative around governance feminism. It presents feminism as less complicated, like less nuanced than I think it is.
Yeah.
So I think like when Janet Halley and people are writing from the US about the dominance of Catherine McKinnon and how she's taken over globally, well, that's true. But a lot of those people in the governance feminist tradition now want to kind of take a break from feminism. And I don't really think that you need to do that, because I don't think feminism can be reduced to, you know, radical feminism or indeed liberal feminism. And I think, again, that's the kind of perspective that comes from the States, where they don't really talk about class or Marxism.
No.
So to me, they're being a bit blind in their conception of feminism.
Yeah, I was quite interested the other day, because obviously, you know, like I don't have like a particularly fond attachment to radical feminists. But, you know, when I was going back over the porn wars, one of the, I think the only sort of like feminists outside of the third world, like sort of feminists, like black feminists that were talking about, you know, the impact of pornography on black men was actually Andrea Dworkin, you know. Yeah. And I think we do the discussion a lot of damage because we you know, we get blinded by these arguments. But it's almost like, because sort of like early feminism has its basis in discussions about prostitution and then pornography, we're almost blinded. Like I'm starting to think that actually we need a sorbet moment here, where we actually stand back, let some other people examine sex work for a while, and then come back having had a bit of a refresher, you know.
No, I think that's interesting. And I feel quite heartened by like the students. I definitely know it's a change over time. And I think it's like as kind of economic and social conditions have got, you know, worse, and like students now at university, all they've known is kind of crisis. Like they're much more receptive, I think, to ways of thinking about class and intersectionality than students were in previous times. So I wonder if some of it's a kind of generational shift too. But I think it's really important to definitely decenter radical feminist debates, but not too much buy into the critique coming from the kind of Janet Halley school of thought, because I do think they're again writing from a US context, as if they're talking about feminism globally, and it's like, well, that's not all feminism.
Yeah, and I think then you kind of like get into this debate about the limitations of feminist standpoint theory.
That
definitely needs a revisit, because, you know, when I was researching my thesis, and I a feminist standpoint is not the same as a sex worker's standpoint.
Yeah. You know?
By virtue of your adherence to feminism does not give you an insight into sex work. You know, you might have an opinion about it, but you haven't necessarily got an insight. And it, you know, I find that really interesting as well. I find that kind of like that there's an assumption, you know, like there's an assumption around the narrative around sex work that feminism has an entitlement to sex work. Yeah. You know, you wouldn't use a feminist sort of standpoint for any other type of work, I don't think. I don't think you'd have a feminist standpoint about plumbing.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think, it's always difficult, isn't it, to think about a feminist standpoint being based on experience alone. But I think the way that I've, you know, been thinking about the kind of feminist standpoint theory is it's kind of more of a kind of, it's not an individual standpoint, it's something that you really reach collectively that's always going to be antagonistic and open to being contested. And as long as you are okay with that, then that's about the best you can do. Like, you can't, like, it's, I think that, like, I would define as a Marxist feminist, but I don't think that radical feminism or liberal feminism is necessarily wrong. I just think that it's limited.
Yeah.
And so I take parts of it that I find useful, but I wouldn't reduce, I think it's like Drusilla Cornell said about Catherine MacKinnon, that she tells a truth, but only a partial truth.
Yeah.
I've always found that as a useful way of thinking. Of course, like, sex work, you know, is gendered in the sense, and, you know, there are sexist assumptions that, you know, circulate and that, you know, structure the exchange, you know, like, that's definitely true.
Yeah. So what, you know, we've touched on a couple of, like, pieces of work that you've done. What else are you involved in?
So at the moment, well, I mean, I think this is interesting because I'm interested in gender and work. What I'm looking at the moment, like, is I've got this UKRI grant that's looking at the impact of COVID on early years childcare.
Okay.
So, like, that's something, another project that I'm working on, which I kind of see is kind of similar to my interest in sex work, in that, you know, I'm again looking at work through a gender perspective and thinking about the labour law implications and social welfare protections. And then the other thing that I'm doing is trying to write the book, which is based on my PhD, which is called Sex Worker Rights Activism in the UK Within and Against the Law, which is, yeah, as I said, based on my PhD, and it's split into two parts. So the first part is about how rights can be used to decriminalise sex work. And then the second part is thinking beyond decriminalisation. And it's kind of imaginary in the sense that that's not where we are. But thinking about how labour rights and social welfare protections and things like a basic income could apply to sex workers. That's the second part of the book. And so that's the other project I'm working on.
Okay, that's quite interesting and quite optimistic, because I sort of, like, the way that I see it, I don't know if you agree with this, but the way that I see the debates around sex work, there are some forms of sex work that are entirely lost now because you can never reverse that discourse around victimization. So, you know, there is never going to be a return to sort of, like, street sex work, because, you know, the debate around victimization has become so pervasive. But it's almost like there's other types of sex work that are largely ignored.
Yeah.
And so they sort of, like, achieve a sort of economic mainstreaming that we haven't seen since, like, you know, the Middle Ages. Yeah. So I'm really interested in that idea, that in the sort of, like, the kind of that idea of, like, some forms of labour being what's that word, so precarious that in between those times, like, sex work would be a go-to. And I'm thinking about, you know, the wool trade in Britain in medieval times, and, you know, the origin of the word spinster is that interchangeable with the word, like, sort of prostitute. And I think that's, me personally, I wonder if that's the best that we can hope for, is that we just get, you know, that people just get left alone to do what it is that they want to do, you know, whether it's quite optimistic to expect a basic wage at a point where there seems to be no labour rights for anyone.
Well, yeah, I mean, I definitely. And I think that the second part of the book is, you know, I try not to make it too idealistic, in the sense that, you know, these things might seem a bit pie in the sky. But I would say that, you know, gig workers are contesting their employment status, and there is, although it's difficult to imagine labour law applying to all precarious workers, I guess that's the nature, I would think, of the kind of class struggle. Like, that's what you always, it's never won once and for capitalists, because they depend on us.
Yeah.
So they need us, really. And so we're always going to fight for better conditions. So, like, to eliminate us would mean that the end of, like, that would, that's a communist manifesto thing, isn't it? They'd hang themselves by their own rope. Like, so they're going to try and give us as little as possible, but we're always going to argue for more. And I mean, I was really hopeful that we would have a Labour government, and, you know, Jeremy Corbyn and people were in favour of kind of decriminalisation and thinking through things like a basic wage, which I think would really help a huge amount of workers, whether they're employees or self-employed. But yeah, some part of what I'm interested in at the end of the book is thinking about sex work as an interesting case study for thinking about, you know, the value that we attach to work and why we work so much, and like what I guess this would be another book, but you know, thinking of what would sex work look like if we didn't live in a capitalist society, because we'd still work, like, but we wouldn't work in the way that we do now. So what might that look like? And starting to think about some of the sorts of laws that you'd want in place to protect people who exchange sexual services.
Yeah, I mean, that was one of the themes that came through in my research, is that one of the reasons people particularly liked sex work, and I was like interviewing people that are webcammed, was because they could earn a really good wage in a relatively short time.
Yeah, I mean, and that totally makes sense, isn't it? It's like, why wouldn't people do it? If you can cope with the kind of stigma and all of those things that come with it,
yeah,
then it makes complete sense. And I do think, you know, that I don't think it's worse work, but society thinks it's worse work. So, you know, and so sex workers have to deal with that kind of stigma, which I think must be very difficult in their lives. But if people can negotiate that and it's the best option available to them, that doesn't mean I think it's okay, but I understand the choice and I think it's very rational.
Yeah. So let's kind of like give you this opportunity for a shameless plug of who you are and the title of the book that your chapter features in.
All right. So me, Dr. Katie Cruz. And what I would encourage people to do is to look out for this forthcoming book, which is going to be published, I think, by Routledge, called Sex Worker Rights Activism and the Politics of Rights Within and Against the Law. And it should be published next year. And it will be the first book that kind of documents the history of the sex worker rights movement in the UK and thinks through the possibilities and limits of law for achieving rights for sex workers.
Excellent. And my name is Rachel Stewart, and I'm a PhD researcher at the University of Kent.